morning, everybody. It's Tim and examine before we get into things like the gas pipeline and other interesting.
Mr. Chairman, I realize, thank you, I realize that this particular piece of legislation has a little bit of controversy to it from different aspects of fundraising for political campaigns, for full disclosure of, you know, I know that Representative Gruenberg raised the issue about personal's right to freedom and whatever and all that sort of thing. So, and I understand also that there was an initiative that passed that was sponsored by some legislators that the public voted on, and I also believe that most of the information, if not all the information that's in this bill, had it been in the initiative, that initiative would have passed at least as overwhelming as it did, maybe more so. It's just you know how the initiative was drafted up, and of course it met the public's interest, and I believe that the information in this bill strengthens the initiative, doesn't weaken it. It certainly doesn't eliminate it, which of course is illegal, as you know, within 2 years of a passive initiative. But what is legal is to amend, as long as you amend in a manner that doesn't significantly weaken the initiative. And this doesn't do that at all. In fact, it strengthens the intent of the initiative, which was to reduce the amount of money allowed to be going into both individuals and PACs. And this actually brings, the proposal anyway, brings the amount of money that a PAC can contribute to a candidate in a year to the same as an individual contribute in a year. And the reason why I'm proposing that is that I think that the public wants to have the individual have the most influence on an election, not a group, any group, whether it be a party, whether it be a PAC of any type, business PAC, labor PAC, any other type of PAC, the public is asking for they themselves to determine who the winner is, not some group that may have an agenda, whoever that group may be. And that's all I'm trying to say, is to somewhat diminish the ability of any group, a business group, a labor group, whatever, to influence the outcome of an election more so than an individual should be able to.
And that's
you know, the other part of the Mr. Chairman, the other part of the bill that I want to make sure at least gets a fair hearing, whether or not it becomes law or not is debatable at this point in time, but is that full disclosure should be there. I think the public is demanding full disclosure in ethics. We certainly are talking about that, and I think the public wants that. They want to know who contributed, how much they contributed, and who they're contributing to. It's not against, I don't think, a person's freedom, because nobody's forced to do any of this kind of stuff. It's all voluntary. But if they do contribute to any group or any legislator, that should be documented. And then a person trying to make a decision on who they want to vote for can determine if a person is controlled or not controlled, in their mind anyway, in the public's mind, by who they receive money from. And that's all. That's really all we're trying to do here. It's a full disclosure. It's a full disclosure bill, and a bill that also tries to reduce the influence of even more so of groups, which may or may not be controlled by small groups of people.
I want to ask you, Mr. Speaker. You'd indicated that PACs and so on. Would you? And then you mentioned party. Would you? What's the maximum that a party can give to a candidate now?
I believe it went from 20,000 down to 10,000, and or maybe it was from 10,000 to 5,000. 10,000 to 5,000.
To an individual candidate.
To an individual candidate, yes.
So then, to be consistent, would you recommend that we go down to 500 for parties?
I'm not concerned about that one way or the other. That doesn't. I don't care. I mean, to be consistent, it would not bother me a bit.
Would you not?
It wouldn't bother me, quite frankly. And I know this is probably going to make a lot of people upset. It wouldn't bother me that, and I don't think it's legal, but that PACs and party money and all that were eliminated completely. Just have it individual contributions. I mean, if that's what we're looking at, I mean, if you want, but I'm not sure that's legal, but I'm not a lawyer. Representative Grunberg is, but obviously.
He's okay otherwise.
Obviously
you'll notice I perked right up.
Obviously, the courts would make that decision if that was proposed. I'm not proposing that, but I'm just saying, because basically what you have with parties is you have an equality thing. Democrat and Republican parties alike can contribute the same amount to a party, to an individual candidate if they so choose. What you end up with in the difference between PACs and groups are PACs. Parties are described as groups. I guess you could change the definition of parties if you wanted to, that they're not groups. But what I'm trying to get at is not to the elimination of PACs, not the elimination of groups, but to say, where should the influence be, financially, monetarily, on a candidate? Should the influence be with the general public, one-on-one, individuals? And Mr. Chairman, we can get into the argument that rich people can afford to give $500 more than poor people, and that's true. But let me tell you what. There's a whole heck of a lot more poor people than there are rich people, and they also a whole lot more voters that are less affluent than those that are. And if they choose to participate in the process, can control the process. A lot of times they just don't choose to participate. So that I don't buy that argument that, again, you benefit the rich people because they can contribute $500 and a poor person can't. I'm saying that a person who's poor or poorer, it doesn't have the right to vote taken away from them, and they can also be influenced through information that's gone out through these groups, whether they be PACs or unions or business groups or whatever they may be. I'm a union member, 32 years with the Teamsters, and I think I'm the only legislator. I was thinking about this morning. I believe I'm the only legislator that's a working union member. That's an actual working union member today. There's some that still belong to unions, but they're not working, as best I know. I am. Unfortunately, last year I didn't, but didn't mean I didn't try. I come from both a business person's perspective. I grew up in a family business that was an organized that hired organized laborers, Teamsters, operators, laborers, electricians, you name it. I have no, again, I know that it's been characterized by some folks that this is union bashing or I'm anti-union. I'm far from that. But all I'm trying to do is let's look at the issue. Again, whether or not it becomes law or not is debatable. But the issue certainly needs to be brought out because it was brought out both in the initiative process as the campaign went forward and in since then. So anyway. Thank you,
I'm not a current union member in the past. Of course, I've been a member of the NEA and CTA and the whatever it is for Alaska, but I'm not now, so I, you know, I've had my...
So there are a lot of Ripley Roses.
Ripley Roses is too, but I wanted to point that out. On the initiative thing, the reason why I brought that up the other day is that you may not know that there was some concern expressed that on the recent cruise ship initiative that passed, which includes a tax on gambling, that if in fact we tax the gambling, that could open up gambling to every place in the state of Alaska. If you tax one thing, it makes it de facto legal for every place. And so I checked with Ledge Legal, and they said, yes, that's right. We could have gambling casinos every other block because of the cruise ship initiative. Then I got an opinion from the Attorney General, and he said just precisely the opposite. Now, I understand that the cruise ship initiative had several different portions of it. We had the head tax. We had the disclosure of whom the contract were, the, you know, on shore for tours and so on. We had some of the other... and also I've got a note, the gambling opens up potential gambling on Indian lands and so on.
My bill doesn't deal with gambling, Mr. Chairman.
Right. Well, but the principle is that's an initiative. And that has several different parts of that initiative, not just the head tax, which most of us think of. But that was an initiative. And so we had one side saying, no, you can't change it. The other side said, yes, you can. And now we come to this bill, which is the topic of our discussion this morning. And we have Ledge Legal says, apparently, and I haven't had a chance to read this opinion, I guess you can brief us on it, that this wouldn't go to the heart of the issue. But I wonder what the administration people, the Attorney General and so on, has to say about it. And do you have any insight on that?
I don't, Mr. Chairman. And like you know, and the member to your left would concur, you can ask two different attorneys an opinion, and you're probably likely to get two different opinions.
I'd say
Depending upon the issue. And I don't know. The courts would, I guess, if it was challenged in court, would determine it. It's not my intent to eliminate the initiative. Actually, my intent to strengthen the initiative. I mean, in the direction that it was going, it was going to reduce the amount of money involved in campaigns. It reduced the amount from $1,000 per individual to $500. It reduced the amount from PACs from $2,000 to $1,000.
Right.
And all I was attempting to do, at least make the suggestion and get the discussion going, which I think I've been pretty successful about doing.
You got some discussion.
is to bring PACs down to the same as an individual. Now, you know, I mean, it's debatable whether or not that is, you know, contrary to the thinking of the initiative. But if it is, then, you know, and I would stand by what the legal decision was and would back away from what the laws, change in law is trying to do. But at this point in time, I don't have a decision from our Ledge Legal and or the Attorney General that says that what we're doing or what we're proposing is illegal. But
I believe Representative Rosa had a question.
I did have. Thank you, to the Chair.
Thank you.
I appreciate the comments, and you and I have had a couple of conversations regarding this because I think you know where my position is on part of this bill. But it's my understanding from what you have here is that in the PAC, every contribution would have to be reported.
That's correct.
And I see that in two different ways, being reported to APOC or being reported to the public. Because if we were to create some kind of a firewall, because APOC is the one that is the enforcement side of the issue on campaign contributions, so if there were a way to create a firewall where one would require the reporting but not necessarily have to make full public disclosure of that, so that if there were a challenge to the process, then APOC could then go in and determine whether or not there was any violations in terms of lobbyists contributing or this, that, or the other, that the information would be on file if we needed to have it for any kind of an investigation. And let me tell you why I have a concern about that, because I think the unintended consequences of having the reporting of every name and address of every union member then leads very easily to those folks out there that want to organize to try to break unions. That's one issue. Mm-hmm. The other issue is we have law enforcement officers that belong to organized labor. Mm-hmm. If they contribute to their PAC, then their name and address is going to be given. And I'm not sure every police officer necessarily wants to have their name and address given out to everybody in the public. Same thing with those that are probation officers or those that are, you know, other types of law enforcement that have to, unfortunately, on a daily basis, deal with some of the seedier side of our society. And so I don't necessarily think that we have, you know, I know those aren't the unintended consequences, you know, that we want to see happen, but I have some fear that we create something that is becomes difficult to manage. So, you know, if there were a way of creating a firewall to protect those kinds of things, then I wouldn't have a problem with it. But I also see it as a way for folks to try to organize to break the unions, and I don't want to see that happen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rose is through the chair. I would not disagree with you a bit. That's certainly not my intention to have, you know, as a union member myself, I understand the attempts to break the unions. I've seen it up close and personal. If it's the intent of the committee or as we move through the process or if it moves through the process, that would certainly, I would not be objectionable at all to doing that, to protect the rights of folks who might be, who might feel like their right to privacy, so to speak, on those types of issues would be infringed. I wouldn't have a problem with that at all. I'm talking about, you know, mostly what I'm talking about is making sure that all contributions to candidates are, and that's the case today, but to make sure that they are all recorded. There isn't any. There used to be, as you may recall, there used to be provision in campaign finance that allowed for monies $100 or less to not be reported individually. In other words, all you did was fill out at the bottom of your form, received X amount of dollars, less than $100 per contribution. I want to make sure that that doesn't exist under any circumstance. So anybody that contributes to a candidate individually, that should be recorded, whether they give $5 or whether they give $500 or whatever the limit is. So that's my main concern. It's certainly not to infringe upon police officers or firemen or anybody else, teachers or anybody else.
Just follow up if I might.
Yes, Representative Rosas.
And I've had this discussion with some others, and I think another area that people have some concerns with is the cruise ship industry was brought up, so I use that as a hypothetical example. Let's say if the cruise ship industry had a pact, and so you've got the cruise ship pact. Well, inside that, you've got the busboys pact, and then inside that, you got the cruise ship waiters pact. Well, on one cruise going one way, the guy's the busboy. On the other cruise going the other way, the guy's the waiter. So does he then get contribute in all three of those packs? And so that's part of the concern that some of the other folks have brought up, is that you can have multiple layers of people contributing to packs really inside the same large pack to begin with.
Right.
And so that's why they were talking about disclosure. So, again, I don't want to see that type of thing happen because it does give an unfair advantage to one particular group over another. But, again, that would be something that if we had this firewall, that it would be easy for the folks at APOC to be able to pick up if those kinds of things were happening. So,
yeah.
This is difficult.
Yeah. Representative Rose is through the chair. One issue that I think it's already in law that if you contribute more than $100, that it's to a group or pack, that's disclosed, and I don't have any. I think that should remain there. I'm saying 100 or less, you know, smaller contributions. You know, it was pointed out to me that the state employees union has a voluntary situation that the state actually writes a check to the PAC for a voluntary contribution that a state employee makes to the PAC. And, you know, some people will question that. Is that the job of the state, or is that the job of the employer to have to write to be basically forced to write a check from somebody's payroll to a PAC? I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that's an issue. But those numbers are small. They're not a lot of money coming out of each check. and they don't add up to a whole lot of money. In fact, one was like $39 or $50 a year or something like that. But the state still goes through the expense of writing the check and sending it to the PAC each year. Again, it's not a mandatory deduction. It's something that a person has to volunteer to do. They either mark a check or whatever when they are hired or whatever they choose to do. But those are issues out there. You know, I read over the white paper that Representative Berkowitz and Webb Shea, and I thought when I first read it that there were comments about PACs in that, but I read it again and I couldn't find it. But I'm gonna call my good friend Representative Berkowitz and ask him again about that, because I maybe it was a conversation I had with him that he had some concern about this issue, and I want to try to get to the bottom of it and see if he did or not. But I know that in some communication I've had with folks that those issues have been brought up, and they are complicated. They're not just the simple slam dunk, you know, and I don't intend to make it sound like the issue is simple, because it's not. We certainly have to try to protect the rights of people from being abused by the public and for whatever reasons, because they choose to participate. But yet we also want to make sure that we honor the public's sort of desire to have as much full disclosure as possible.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things. I want to go back to the state basically expending funds to get money to political groups. I want to deal with that some other time, but not now. I haven't looked at the voter rolls, but I'm pretty sure that APOC doesn't vote.
I beg your pardon?
APOC does not vote.
They
don't have a vote. They have individual votes, but they don't vote. I think what we need to look at is accountability for candidates and who gives them money. I think full disclosure is essential. And once again, we need to reinstill the confidence in the public that we're working on their behalf. And I think the way we do that, it's an old cliche, but follow the money. The other part that Representative Rose has brought up, it would be very simple for a policeman or a fireman or a teacher. Use the business address. You don't have to give your home address. Maybe we could change the law to where when you file, Craig Johnson, State Capitol Building, Juneau, Alaska, I don't have to give my home address. But you've got a name, you've got some accountability, you know how much it is. I don't think we need to invade these people's privacy. We just simply allow them to report their business address. So I think that's a simple way around that problem. And I don't think we've invaded anyone's privacy, and we stopped the union busting issue. But we do have accountability. And I do want to point out that all these contributions, I've heard time and time again, are 100% voluntary. No one has to do it.
Any follow-up on that? Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, I appreciate the willingness and the ability to try to solve problems I'm hearing today. And that goes on both sides of the aisle, too. I want you to know, at least as far as this representative is concerned. We've had a number of amendments, and I really want to look and see what all of these do. And the bill will go to judiciary after this. I'm not going to comment really on anything more than that, other than to thank everybody who's spoken, because it's been very helpful to me. And if we can reach accommodation on these issues, I think that will go some way towards helping craft some law that people can live with around here. I would like to just point out one thing. You have a couple of memos here, legal memos, and I hopefully will have time in this committee, and I'm talking to the chair a little bit, to study these amendments and everything else a little more before the bill moves. I would just like to suggest that these memos are a good start, but they don't really, either one, completely answer the question. The longer memo, which is the constitutionality of amending the statute, doesn't discuss, for example, the Superior Court decision on the We the People initiative. I realize that was prior to the passage of any initiative, but I think that some of the discussion in that, I am told, might be helpful. I'm trying to get a copy of that. I think it's a Superior Court decision, and I want to take a look at it, and possibly Ledge Legal ought to take a look before issuing a final decision on that. Secondly, and this is, I think, equally important, the other legal memo. In the first paragraph, a survey of existing laws dealing, it said you have inquired about existing law concerning campaign contributions and whether they could be subject to contribution limits. I think this emanated from my line of questioning last time, and the record will reflect whether that's correct. I was not asking at all about that question. The question wasn't, well, maybe to some extent, but I was even more interested in whether they could be the subject to required disclosure. And that's quite a different question than contribution limits. And maybe for that reason, Ledge Legal did not discuss the constitutionality of requiring these issue groups to disclose their donors. And I think that that's a question that needs to be answered. The cases, glancing just a few minutes ago at the cases, none of them seem to deal with disclosures. They're all contribution limits, which are subject, obviously, to free speech protection. I don't know that disclosure is, except in the anonymity aspect. And frankly, if they have a right to anonymity constitutionally, might not contributors to individual candidates have some constitutionally protected right of privacy also? And none of these cases really discuss that aspect, any disclosure, and the impact of the Alaska State Constitution right to privacy in Article 1, Section 22, which is broader than the federal right to privacy, in my opinion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunberg, through the chair, you know, you bring up some, you know, obviously this bill is going to be, is going to move on to judiciary at some point in time, and those issues. What you have is a promise from me as a carrier of the bill that if I get an attorney general's opinion or you get an attorney general's opinion, whoever does, that says that, you know, we're violating the intent of the law or the law as we know it, you know, I'm not pursuing it. I'm not going to pursue it any further. I mean, I respect the law and I respect the opinions of the attorney general. But, you know, obviously, you know, then the only recourse if somebody really wants to pursue this issue further is in another initiative in the next ballot, you know, in the next election process, which would then be legal if it was done, you know, correctly, just as this initiative was legal, or at least nobody's challenged it to this point. But if you're correct, I mean, if your assumption is correct that the right to privacy carries over pretty in-depth, then probably any contribution to any candidate could be deemed under the right of privacy, and no contribution. A limit could be set, but no contribution would then have to be reported.
I don't know. Sometimes, through the chair, sometimes it's not an absolute ban, and, you know, the legislature may have a very definite interest in requiring the disclosure of contributions above a certain amount. But when you get down to a small amount,
right,
they may be subject to greater constitutional protection.
Yeah, understanding, Mr. Chair, Representative Grunberg, through the chair, understanding, I am not opposing the concept of the smaller amounts not having to be reported.
Would you repeat that, please?
I said I am not opposing, as was brought up by Representative Roses earlier, I am not opposing the small amount. As long as the aggregate amount wasn't over that, I am not opposing the $100 or less not being reported.
Well,
to a group, not to a candidate, but to a group.
Yeah, because if I'm giving $25 to a candidate or $25 to a group, which I know is going to be supporting a certain group of candidates, the constitutional protection should still remain.
Well, that's obviously if the Attorney General is coming out with that position.
Well, let me ask you a question. How about, through the chair, how about if the Attorney General or somebody doesn't come out with that opinion that they're constitutionally protected, how about on a policy basis?
Well, that has to be debated. The merits of the bill as it's presented right now are to have full disclosure. I'm not in the business of trying to bust unions or to hurt people who have selected type of jobs that might have their privacy infringed, or if they contribute, a police officer or somebody that somebody might go after and that sort of thing. But I think Representative Johnson brought up alternative, and I'd like to work through that issue to see if there was a way to protect folks, but yet to have the disclosure still as well. So I mean, it's still a debatable issue. I'd really like to discuss the judiciary aspects of this, the legal aspects of this, in a committee of jurisdiction in judiciary, if possible. But I'm still open to the discussion.
If I may, with follow up.
Yes, please.
Long time ago, I clerked for the Alaska Supreme Court. And judges, in interpreting the Constitution, whether they say so explicitly or not, are really, at that level, to some extent, looking at the policy that's involved. They can put it in terms of precedent and history, text, but ultimately it comes down to some extent to a choice of practical implication and policy. We have a tougher job because we can't couch our reference behind precedent and policy. We are forced more often than the court system in determining what's good public policy. And that makes for tougher decisions in many cases, and this happens to be one of them. And the question I'm asking you, through the chair, is whether somebody who makes a small contribution, whether it's to an individual candidate or to a PAC, small amount. I'm not talking about a union member who's going to get busted. I'm talking about the person in the street. Whether they should have an expectation that their $10, $25, $50 contribution should be private. We have a $1 checkoff on the federal income tax. Because logically, if everything is reported, then everybody who checks that $1 off has no expectation that the world won't know that they're giving a dollar. Is that good public policy to go down to that kind of a level and report everybody who gives a tiny amount? I know I've had some $1 contributions, and I remember them. They were from 8-year-old twins. Each one gave a buck.
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, at this point in time, without more debate, and the intent of the bill is to have full disclosure for everybody. Now, I understand and the issues that have been brought up, and I respect that about what would happen if some people were targeted, so to speak, and I understand that, and that's certainly a legal rights issue. But at this point in time, I'm not advocating that. That there be exemptions. I'm advocating full disclosure, and if we get into a legal issue one way or the other, I definitely for sure want full disclosure to candidates for sure, and parties or PACs could be debated, I suppose, but definitely for all candidates, and then beyond that, I think the merits certainly are worth debating. But the bill as it stands requires all contributions.
I understand. With just one more sentence.
One more, then we're going to Reverend Coggerell after that.
We have had a whole series of bills on Patriot Act, entering into information into national databases, identity theft, everything else. And when your name is entered into a database, subject to identity theft and everything else, and I think people are really concerned about that.
Representative Cogdill. Yeah.
I understand that, but understand, Mr. Chairman, understand that. But remember, it's all voluntary. Nobody has a gun to their head to say you have to contribute to anybody for any reason. It's 100% voluntary.
Reverend Cargo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, first of all, I think one of the problems that arises out of the $100 limit that allows for kind of anonymity is what I described the other day, and that is you could come up with a lot of money and assign names to it, and nobody really knows. So I think because of the effect that it has on elections, you want to know if there's credibility to that money. So for me personally, that's how I look at it. So and I agree that for groups to go ahead and gather money together from their prospective supporters and then collectively put that together and send it off to a candidate, the group itself probably needs to be the more accountable. I understand that. So it might be the better thing to do is to limit those groups' abilities. But I was just talking with so parties and groups are the same thing. Parties are made for the express purpose of helping candidates get elected and promoting political philosophy. And if groups are going to act under that same auspices, then that's just what's going to have to happen. It might change the actual dynamics of elections where people have to be engaged beyond their group. I was last night doing my APOC report. Painful operation. I've come off $24 off. I don't know where I did that, but
you're being recorded here.
Yeah,
it's a bank charge.
But everybody who wrote me a check is recorded. Whether they're and then at a certain level, I give their employer. They don't have any anonymity, and many of the groups that have given me money, they're identified. So there is a. But where did they get that money from? Is that really the question we need to ask? Where does the Republican Party get their money from? Where does the Democratic Party get their money from? I think when a group has a contributor list that have contributors over $100, we can find out. So let's just say $20 million goes into Alaska's campaign, and we don't know where the $20 million came from because they all fly under the $100 limit. That is a significant impact to the policy of Alaska. And I've heard that number at least once in this testimony. So if we're going to require it of political parties that they tell us who is giving it from $100 and up, we certainly would be requiring it for $100 and below. Same thing with groups. My guess is that would change the dynamic of how groups worked, because there are some people that don't want their name out there on that list. But I can tell you, everybody who has put their $101 out there, they're on that list. And so then the question is, I guess a little on the philosophical side, and that is, if you're going to participate in elections, whether it's voting, because that's available, just the simple act of voting, that's available whether you did or didn't vote. We can find that out. We can actually find out your name and address if you voted. Do you want the anonymity to go down to just the simple act of a vote? Or if you're going to participate in elections at all, can people know who you are? I really don't have a problem with that. And so to say that a certain group deserve anonymity over the other, I struggle with. So, and so therefore, I'm going to probably head in a direction of doing this without trying to bust anybody, because there's people above that list that can already be busted, and it hasn't happened as far as I know. Except for maybe on one occasion, I know, where a particular group decided that they were going to picket a certain business because of political action that they were doing. But it's a free society. They had the right to picket. I did not complain about that. I got angry at them, but they had the right. So you have the right to participate. You have the right not to participate.
Attorney Dahl?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Yes, I, you know, and I realize that we're here to serve the public. And finding that fine line on how to serve the public, whether it's finding that disclosure or also helping them participate in the political process. And I'm very happy that you're looking at that and questioning and asking those kinds of questions, Representative Harris. I happen to myself believe that we hinder the public participation by asking those small donors that 50 cents the dollar, the one that stops you in the supermarket and says, here, I've got some, literally this quite happens, and I know it happens to all of us, digs in their pocket, finds $3 and hands it to you.
That's illegal, by the way.
And then you have to, you know, and taking a cash contribution, but then you have to say, well, wait a minute, you know, I've got to, you know, your name, your, you know, so forth and so forth. And but my point being here is that we want participation from the public into this process, and I believe there's a point where this would hinder that whole process and would stop people from participating. And I also just question, and I don't know the answer to this, Representative Rose, but I'm not sure we can do a firewall, because once anything goes to APOC, it is public, and it can be taken out. So that would be my concern on that.
Okay. I believe we have Representative Johnson, you're next.
Thank you. A couple things, and one's on the ability to amend initiative, and I have passed out to everyone a court case, Clifford Warren versus Lowell Thomas, which is a case where the legislature did in fact change an initiative, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court and was upheld. So the depth of that and the amount of changes is the discussion, but it's not like we're in new ground by doing that. It's been done before. Secondly, and I think most importantly, is I'd like to step back from this a little bit and look at maybe a bigger picture. We have a crisis of confidence in this state with our elected officials. It may be a little dramatic, but I don't think the citizens of this state have a lot of confidence in us or any elected official. I think there is a cloud over us, and I think that it is incumbent on us to remove that cloud. And anything that we can do to open that process up and to show the people that we are here doing their work, that's where we need to be. It's almost like the TSA when you go to the airport. Nobody likes it. You've got to go through the hassles. You've got to go through the stuff. It takes more time. But in every time you see an interview, what do they say? It's a hassle, but I feel safer. And that's really what we're doing here. We're hassling people a little bit. It's a little inconvenient. But the citizens of this state have a right to know and have confidence in this body that we're acting on their behalf and not some special interest that we haven't been bought and paid for. I don't believe anyone here has, but we need to reinstill that confidence back into the community and back into the public. This is a great way to do it. Total disclosure, full disclosure, every penny donated to a campaign is accounted for. And we need to be accountable. We need to send that message.
Representative Dahl.
Yeah, just another comment. I had someone approach me yesterday and said that if this bill should pass, making it very, very difficult and cumbersome for people to donate small amounts, it would be an incumbent's dream. And I think what they meant by that is that when people run for office for the first time, they typically get their monies in small amounts from grassroots. And by making this very difficult and cumbersome to do it, both on the end of the candidate and on the person who's campaigning, it would make it very difficult to run for office and receive the funds that you need to challenge an incumbent who already has a war chest. So I might just bring that out as a remark that was given to me yesterday, and I would put it in the record.
Representative Dahl, through the chair, can I correct you on a couple things? First of all, you made a comment earlier about reporting cash contributions. I hope you're not doing that. That is illegal,
right?
First of all, you cannot accept cash contributions. Number two, this does not affect change the law the way it is today to a candidate. This is to groups.
Right.
Yes. This is to groups. Right now, you must report every dollar, every cent, every dime that you get on your form. It does not affect incumbents any more than it does challengers. It is absolutely the same.
Through the chair, I was not referring to groups. I was referring to individual contributors.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure I get an understanding. Individual contributors to you as a candidate or to you as a legislator are not changing here. Right now, you must report every contribution that you get, whether it's $1, $5, or $500. You must report it now. It does not change that one iota.
Yes, through the chair.
Right.
I understand that. What we're asking here is additional information on employer and occupation.
Yeah, I've got, I don't know if you had a chance to look at it yet. I've not offered the amendment yet, because it seems to me that we're all very concerned here about having some transparency of where all this money is coming from. And it looks like it's covered pretty well for individuals. As you just explained, that we all have to report everything we get. And we're concerned about money that some of us get through PACs, and that these people should be in actually disclosed who contribute to PACs.
Right.
And are we concerned that that some people are controlling these PACs? Let me put it this way. I have a proposed amendment which I've not yet offered, and I don't know if you had a chance to see it or not, Mr. Speaker. And I'll just read it to you. It's very short. It says, notwithstanding other provisions of this chapter, a group that is not a political party is not required to report under AS so-and-so and is not required to file a report under B the section unless 90% or more of the aggregate amount of all contributions made to the group is attributable to contributions of 10 or fewer contributors. Now, I can see a situation where Steve Forbes and Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and maybe a couple other folks would get together and form a very small PAC and contribute tremendous amounts of money to a PAC. Well, obviously, follow the money, that needs to be reported. That's a far different thing than folks giving 10, 20 bucks through their paycheck. And if we're concerned about following the money, to me, this addresses that concern, and we don't get into the thicket that we've been talking about before. What's your general comment on this?
Chairman,
I've not offered the amendment. I may offer it, may not.
Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, and I'm not an expert on campaign finance, and don't probably want to be either, but I think that there are rules on PACs about how much they can contribute based upon how large a membership they have. I think that there's I think APOC has certain rules about that. Folks who deal with that on an everyday basis, much better concept of that, but I believe the size of your membership may determine how much money you can actually put out through the PAC.
Is Tammy Kempton in the audience? Would you help us address this question? Oh, you can say that, Mr. Speaker. Good just glad you came here this morning.
Certainly. Tammy Kempton, Alaska Public Office.
I'd like to recognize that Representative Johansson has joined the group, joined the committee. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, where would you like me to start?
Well, from the beginning, no, Representative Harris indicated some questions about PACs in general, how they can, what you can contribute and so on. Maybe he could repeat the question or concern, and you could help us answer that.
Tammy, this is the amendment that Representative Land is proposing, and the question, his issue was whether or not some small group of people could contribute large amounts of money to the PAC and then spread that out. And my response was, it was my understanding that the amount of money that a PAC could contribute totally to was somewhat based upon the amount of membership they had, and I don't know. Can you describe how PAC works then, as far as?
There is the limit on a PAC isn't how much it can give totally, it's how much it can give to each candidate. Currently, that's $1,000. It can give $1,000 to every candidate in the state if it's got that much money.
So in other words,
makes up a PAC.
In other words, Ms. Kim,
how do you form a PAC, and what and what, you know, can for like?
Can I, if I'm, if there's a PAC that I'm a member of or would like to help, can I give $1 or $1,000 or $1,000,000 to that PAC? Is there any limit to what I could give to that PAC?
Yes.
Not to a candidate, but to the PAC itself. Then of course the PAC is limited on how much it can give to candidates.
Correct, and there is a limit to how much a person can give to a PAC. The only group that can accept unlimited contributions are those that are ballot propositions, ballot initiatives. Those you can give either as an individual or as a company an unlimited amount. However, the contributor, once they've given $500 to a ballot measure group, an initiative group, has to report that $500. They give another $500, they have to report that other. It's an incremental reporting thing. And the group itself, of course, has to report receiving those. But for regular groups, including political parties, there's a limit to the amount that you can contribute.
To a PAC.
To a PAC or to any other group, because a PAC is just a group that's formed to support multiple candidates. A PAC can't support a single candidate, because then it becomes a controlled group and not a PAC. And if I could correct one misstatement. With respect, it is our right to accept cash contributions if you know the identity of the person giving you the cash. If somebody leaves cash in a basket at a fundraiser and you don't know who left it, you have to turn that money over to the state. If the person gives it to you and tells you their name, or you already knew their name, then you can accept it, so long as they don't give you more than $100 aggregate in the election season.
Mr. Chair, but I think the point of the telling was it must be reported.
Yes.
I think that was the point of the discussion.
Right. It is absolutely. If they give you a quarter, you have to report it.
Right.
That's different than when I went through my deal with APOC a couple years ago, that was not my understanding, so I'm glad you corrected me, because my understanding was that you couldn't accept cash at all.
You can up to 100 aggregate in the cycle.
Well, that'll help me a lot.
But you do still have to report it.
Ms. Kempton, you haven't looked at this proposal. I've not made the amendment. I've not moved the amendment, but you may not have a chance to look at it, but if you could glance out of there, is there anything in there that would not be appropriate as far as APOC is concerned?
Hmm.
While you're looking, let me make a comment.
Mr. Chairman, I think what Ms. Kempton said, and thinking about it a little bit, first of all, your scenario was 4 or 5 or even 10 people contribute some money. The law already prohibits people from contributing large amounts of money. I mean, there's a limit to how much you can, whatever that limit is.
That's the proposition.
Well, the law says that, you know, if 4 or 5 or 6 people were to give the maximum amount, you still wouldn't have a whole lot of money there. And they would just be able to divvy that particular amount of money out. If you had 1,000 people in a pack, I mean, if the pack was truly representative, you know, they could, each one of those 1,000 people could contribute the maximum amount that they could to the pack, and the pack would then be able to distribute that amount of money out. You follow what I'm saying?
I'm sorry.
Still working on it.
I apologize. In reading this, so what you're doing is exempting groups from having to file the 24-hour reports, because that's what 110B are the 24-hour reports. Mm-hmm. So that's what you're...
That was not the intent.
No, we need to have this looked at.
I beg your pardon? Representative Grunberg?
We need to have this looked at. By the
Because that's what... Mm. A group that is not a political party is not required to file a report under 1513.110B, and 1513.110B is definitely the 24-hour report. When you get $250 within 9 days before an election, you file a report to APOC within 24 hours of receiving that money. Yeah. And do you mean to exempt groups from that requirement?
No. We had called Les Legal last night around 4:45 or 5 o'clock and tried to explain what we wanted. And so this is what usually happens. And so we just got this distributed to us just as we met. So we hadn't had a chance to proof what they sent. Rather than make a conceptual amendment, we tried to do it this way. So are you saying this? They have the wrong section of the statute, right?
I believe so. If it is not your intent to exempt groups from the 24-hour reporting requirement, then I believe this is the wrong.
Representative Grunberg.
I think it was the intent, and the chair spoke to me about this amendment.
And before you actually saw the actual amendment.
Yeah. Before either, when we just were talking about it, I thought it was a good idea, and I'm sure I'll want to co-sponsor whatever amendment we come up with. It was the intent to exempt them from filing reports, all reports. So this thing actually does it because it is all reports. The under B of this section on line 10 is all other reports, and 110B are the 24-hour reports. So the intent was, as I understand it, to exempt them, everyone who has more than 10 members, from filing any reports. So this is properly drafted.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I can, is it your intent then to say that PACs with more than 10 members don't have to file any reports?
Yeah.
So no disclosure at all then?
Well, it'd be disclosure if they had 10 or fewer people with, and 90% of the money came from that.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I think you're leaving yourself pretty open here.
That was the intent. Absolutely.
We administer the law you give us.
Good political answer. I believe Representative Johnson had a...
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question about, you know, when I go through and I look at even my APOC report, and I'll certainly look at the Speaker's APOC report now for cash contribution.
You won't find it.
I won't find it. That I sometimes, as long as I've been around the system, I mean, I see APAC, GOPAC, GPAC, go-kart, and I don't know what they mean.
Go-kart.
Well, you know, and some of these I'm making up. Some of them I actually wasn't, though. And My understanding is that they have to be clearly identified in their name as a PAC. Part of the problems I have is that I don't know what these groups stand for. I don't know what they mean. If I go and see that Backpack has donated X number of dollars to a candidate, I have no idea what that party stands for. I have no idea what type of influence they may or may not be trying to influence a candidate with. And I want to kind of draw the parallel. When I see a contribution from the Democratic Party, I know. I know their philosophical leanings. They've got a platform. It's very identifiable. The Republican Party's the same way. The Green Party's the same way. When you see a contribution from that, it's very clear. But I just don't know what some of these PACs mean, what they stand for, who they are. Right. And is there any type of rules or regulations that says you must be you must be able to clearly identify who the PAC is from their name?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, no, there's not. There is a statute that says, I'm pretty sure it's a statute, not a reg, but there's one or the other, and it requires all groups formed to support or oppose a candidate clearly identify the name of the candidate and whether they're supporting or opposing the candidate. But there's not a similar requirement that a PAC name itself in such a way that you know what it, you know, philosophically what it's supporting.
Representative Johnson.
And I think that kind of gets, you know, to the root of my concern is that if an individual citizen took the time to go on someone's APOC report and sees Craig Johnson's donated, da-da-da, philosophically, no, but all of a sudden you come up with this backpack group. What do they believe in? Where are they? And that gives me some concern. I think it part of maybe what I want to look at is making groups identify themselves, have some type of mission statement or something that's available to the public. Because I think that is something that, and that's, in terms of full disclosure, right. I think that would be something that would help.
And through the chair, Representative Johnson, when they register with us and if Backpack PAC gave you a contribution, you know, they are required to be registered with us before they can give contributions. So you go to the group section, you find them, and pull up a copy of their registration.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
Can you kind of walk me through what's on? I've never registered a PAC, so I've never even looked at that form. What's on that? Is there anything about philosophy or anything?
Through the chair, when a group registers, one of the things they select on a group registration form is what type of a group they're going to be, whether they're going to be a subsidiary of a political party, a new political party, a PAC, and they have to state what their purpose is. So unfortunately, it could be as simple as supporting or opposing candidates. Some groups get more explicit, some don't. But you could certainly make those requirements.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be, I think that would be something that we should look at is having PACs, you know, as a minimum. If nothing else in this bill passes, in terms which I certainly hope more than this passes, if we could address at some point identifying, because I think it goes along to my mantra, full disclosure. And if we can't have people's names, addresses, like I would like to have, we at a minimum need to know where these groups are, where they come from, who they stand for, who they represent, so that a reasonable person could go on the site and say, this person supports the same people I do, I think I like this candidate. I like his philosophies. I like the people that support him. And use that as part of a decision-making process for actually voting. So that's...
Would you, Representative John, would you investigate that further?
Absolutely.
Perhaps a proposed amendment?
And I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm not sure this is the appropriate, this may not be the bill for it. I mean, there may be other, it may be a standalone piece. I don't think this may not be the vehicle for that type of discussion.
That's on my bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Representative Coghill.
Certainly they could be a directive, but even the discussion could be as simple a matter as aligning information on a web page, for example. with an asterisk or something like that by anybody who's a PAC, and then noticing what their access to information is. Because I don't know that you're going to publish the whole platform, say, of the Republican Party. But if you have a question about a PAC that just is an acronym, to be able to scroll down there and get that, to that link, for example, I think that might be just a matter of good software management.
Representative Johnson.
I don't think I'm suggesting that that APOC start keeping a database of all groups.
Well, they do.
But not the depth that to be able to talk philosophy and stuff. But I do think there is some way that we can, with a name or a little bit of research, be able to find out what these PACs stand for. I think
a mission statement. From the PAC,
or a link to their webpage. I think that's.
I think
that's a great
Mr.
idea,
Chairman. I think the link, because they do have a purpose statement, as we've been told. So, just a matter of getting access to it, I think, is probably the bigger question.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's total disclosure. And
Cody, you said everybody doesn't have access to internet.
Well, I agree, but even if you went and got a member's information, if it was somehow noticed on when you got that person's information, that it would be noticed that you could have access to it. So I will tell you this, though. Those who get the first day's access to that somehow have internet access. It's not the reporters that report into it that have the problem. I mean, that they're the ones that have the problem probably getting information in. But those who report on that probably have very little problem getting that information out.
Anything on this particular topic? Could you explore that for us?
I will do that, thanks.
And while we have you here, Ms. Kempton, I believe it was Representative Roses had mentioned a firewall for people who contribute to PACs, such as public safety, police, troopers, and so on. Would it be practical or possible for APOC to set up some kind of a firewall so that if I'm a cop and I contribute to a PAC, that my name and address would not be there, or some other variation of that?
Unfortunately, I don't know enough about the technology to be able to answer that. I think an easier way, especially because so many computers do get hacked, may be to allow people to use business addresses if they're a state resident. I mean, the reason we require the reason we require the address is because you're only allowed to accept a certain percentage of out-of-state contributions. We don't know whether they're in-state or out-of-state contributions unless you provide the address of your contributors. So if they just provide a business address and the business is in Alaska, they may or may not be an Alaska resident. But if we had an amendment that allowed people, if they were residents, to use their business address, so that firemen, policemen, there's some people who serve on
anybody,
various boards that are very sensitive. We have one of those boards in our building, and they don't even show up on the leaderboard that they're in the building.
Well, even people who, sexual assault, domestic abuse, and so on, may want to contribute to some candidate who wants to help them with this particular issue. Now they've given their address to the assailant.
Exactly.
So, who was it? Were you that brought this subject up, Representative Rogers?
Of the firewall?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. Could you check into that for us? Potential amendment or something?
Through the chair, I'd have no problem checking into that. It's just a matter of whether or not the technology exists and whether or not we have the regulations changed so that they have the ability to do that. Right now, everything they receive has to be reportable. So it would be something we would have to change in order to make that technology even be considered to be used.
Well, prepared to have an amendment in there that states anybody who's a member of law enforcement or some kind of a definition for people who have restraining orders and so on.
Well, let me maybe
something along that line.
Well, let me correct that a little bit. I wasn't singling out that group. I just used them as an example. I said if we were concerned about people accessing addresses of everybody inside of a PAC that wanted to therefore use those names and addresses to potentially organize to break up a union, that would be a way in which you could do it. The information is reported, but if then there are questions about whether or not something was proper or illegal, then you would have to be able to, APOC could then access that, or if there was a question, it could be accessed. But I'll be happy to investigate it for you, but that wasn't actually what I said.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Congo.
This is going to be a little off topic, but I've heard the break the union argument an awful lot, and I'm just up to my ears with it, because if reporting under $100 breaks a union, then we got a problem in America. I just don't believe it. I just don't accept it. Now, I understand the need for privacy, believe me, but I just don't accept that premise that because people report under $100 contributions to a political action committee, that somehow that's going to break a union. I just don't accept that, and I don't accept that it would break a company. I don't accept that it would break the society. I understand that it's cumbersome. That's what I do understand. And I understand that when people want to contribute, they want some degree of protection for their privacy, but that's true when they contribute $101. So I just don't accept the premise that this is just about union breaking.
Could I respond to that, please?
On point, yes.
But thank you. No. And I'll stick to that point.
On that point.
Yes. I wasn't suggesting that the amount of money would lead to that. What I was suggesting was the disclosure of the name and address of each of those individuals. Yeah. Because then it opens up the avenue for them to be contacted through the mail directly and to be solicited. And that's the point. It wasn't the dollar amount. It was the name and address.
Mr. Chairman.
And in terms of reporting the business address, if that's a way around that, then I think it certainly creates some protection. But that was what I referred to, not the dollar amount.
And that could go for businesses who put together a PAC. That could go for groups that have a particular philosophy that want to put together a PAC.
That's true.
So, and that's why I just didn't want it to end up just as a union issue, because it's not a union issue. It's kind of what I was getting at.
I agree.
Mr. Chairman.
And I would agree with that, because we had this discussion at the previous meeting.
Well, it just keeps coming up, and I just thought I'd talk.
Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, the issue is relevant because the initiative, quite frankly, that passed, it used to be that all campaign contributions to PACs and everything else were reportable to any limit.
Years ago.
The initiative changed that. The initiative said anything $100 or less doesn't have to be reported. So the initiative was supposed to be for full disclosure, for more openness, for less contributions. The reality is the initiative under that condition was less disclosure.
Representative Grunberg.
To respond to the Representative Coghill, and to amplify on what Representative Rose has said, unions have traditionally jealously guarded their list to protect their members from harassment. It happens that what has been going on not so recently only, but for a period of time, is that there is a lot of pressure sometimes on union members to bust the unions. And for that reason, they have guarded their lists. This is an attempt to open up that membership list. It won't be solved by listing a business address, because if somebody's intent on using that list of names, all they'll have to do is go to the Division of Elections and find out their address, because that's public information on their voter file. And so they'll still, once they know the name, be able to find out where that person lives and contact them at their home. They'll also certainly know where they work and can contact them on the job. The point is, they'll know who they are.
Mr. Chairman, can I rebut that just briefly? The law before, now Representative Groomer may have factual evidence to his statement, I don't know, but the point is, the law before the initiative was passed required those contributions to be listed, and the names, and I don't know about the names and addresses, I guess, of the contributors. And I don't know, I mean, I'm a union member, been one a long time, paid a lot of dues, but I don't know that the union busting was any different then than it would be now. And if you have factual evidence to, you know, to prove that otherwise, I would stand corrected, but I don't know that.
But through the chair, I'm not suggesting that has changed, because I don't know. I'm suggesting what they're concerned about. And what we're talking about here is the chilling effect. The ability to contribute and to speak out is part of the right to become, to petition the government, become part of the governmental process. It's really an aspect of free speech, and it doesn't take a lot to chill that. Thank you.
Want to respond?
I don't know how I respond to that. I mean, I, like I said, I have a lot of friends who are members of the union. Certainly, businesses, there's probably businesses in this state and businesses across the nation who would like to see less union people than there are. I don't know that campaign contribution. I mean, I think it was just indicated here recently that less than 20% of the workforce in the country is organized labor, and about 35 or 40% of government workers are organized labor nationally. In Alaska, of course, it's much higher, but nationally and in the rest of the workforce, I think it's between 10 to 15% of the workforce is organized labor. Now, am I happy about that? No. I mean, I think unions are great, and I think they do a really good service for a lot of people in the country. And would I promote something that actively tried to union bash or to try and take away people's ability to organize? No. I mean, that's not my intent at all. My intent, again, here is full disclosure. You know, I think what's frustrating to me, Representative Gruenberg, is the initiative that was passed for a reason. I don't know why it was passed. I mean, it was supposedly, you know, for better understanding of the political campaign process, and less money in the system, and, you know, a whole bunch of different reasons, I suppose. But the law before was stricter. The initiative made the law less strict. The law was very, said more people, you had to know about more people that were contributing, and now the law says we have to know about less people that are contributing. And I don't know how we have it both ways here. Do we have, we really want to have more disclosure and we want the public to know what's going on? Or is really the intent to lower the amount of money that both PACs and individuals can contribute, but yet have less disclosure? And that's exactly what the initiative did. And I don't believe, and I don't speak for every person in Alaska, but I don't believe that if the people of the state of Alaska truly knew what that initiative did in all aspects, that they would have liked that part of it. My feeling would be this. If you put what I have in this bill today in the initiative that was put forward before the public, it would have passed as overwhelmingly as it did before.
Mr. Chair, on that last point,
Gruenberg,
since we're getting back to the issue of the initiative, which may be at the legal heart of part of the whether this bill would withstand the court scrutiny, the Constitution says you can't repeal an initiative for 2 years. You can amend it. The problem is, it's a slippery slope. Who knows where an amendment ends and a repealer begins? And we don't know why people vote the way they do, whether it's on the floor of the legislature or in a constitutional amendment setting or in an initiative.
You're saying we don't go to motive?
Yeah, we really don't, because Nobody knows why people vote, and people have a right to keep their reasoning secret. That's a right of privacy. And also, it's in statute, as I recall. All we know is what they did. And if the court or we as a policymaking body, because we really are the first gatekeepers for the protection and interpretation of the right of an initiative, if we start going into each and every initiative and saying, well, we can repeal this little provision over here because we don't really think it's at the heart and influenced many people, but we can't do this over here because we feel it's at the heart, or if a court can do that, that's a dangerous slippery slope, because it will start to undercut the real policy behind the initiative. The real question that we must confront and the court must confront is who decides. And if it's in an initiative, unless it's a technical amendment of some kind, the people's right to be free from change should remain for the two-year period. 2 years isn't very long. If it's a good idea, it'll be good in a year, 18 months, 2 years. That's a very short period. Why can't we wait the 2 years before we try to fool around with this thing when we have a constitutional right to an initiative? That's at the heart of this.
Representative Harris.
Yeah, and we certainly can. But we also have a constitutional right and in statute to amend. If an initiative was put forward that wasn't well explained to the public, which has happened many times, Representative Groenberg, as you know, people are duped in initiatives at times. They have a limited amount of time to understand the issue. Certainly, public pressure and emotion and other things go into initiatives. We allow them. I mean, you know, some states don't allow them. You know, but the point of the matter is we do. But the process, the deliberative process of an initiative is not very good. I think you'd admit to that. It's very difficult. We go through a very deliberative process here when we pass laws. Sometimes it takes years for a law to get changed. Laws are changed by the people in the initiative process in a very short period of time with very limited amount of education. So many times they're based upon emotion. We are a deliberative body, and I think you have to admit to that. We are a very deliberative body. We look at the issue, and if there are issues that are passed in initiative that we as a deliberative body can try to dig down and understand, we have that responsibility to do so on behalf of the people of the state of Alaska. And that's all that's being discussed here. It's whether or not the issues that were put forward in the initiative were fully vetted to the people of the state of Alaska, where they understood what was being debated and what they understood was being voted on. And as this issue continues to be heard, and here on Gavel to Gavel and other places, the people of Alaska will get more information than they ever had through the initiative process. And maybe the legislature will agree that they want to make a change. Maybe they won't. But that is the process that still continues to this day.
I had a professor in law school whom I remember. His name was Michael Tiger, T-I-G-A-R. Some of you may have heard of him, very famous lawyer. And he taught administrative law. And I remember, because the central question on many of these issues, and it's here today, is who decides. That's a real simple way of putting the issue. And when we're talking about the legislature's role in an initiative amendment or repeal or process, the question in my mind is who decides the text of the law. I vote on the side of the people, because the initiative is the last vestige of direct democracy. And I would exercise that right to change an initiative about as often or less often than I would vote to amend the Constitution. It's that serious.
Representative Groenberg, through the chair, then why is it that we have in law the ability to amend an initiative?
because, if I may just respond to that, because sometimes there are typographical errors or tiny unintended consequences that the initiative, for example, may not do what it was intended to do through a drafting problem. There's no requirement that an initiative be professionally drafted. And you can have a handwritten initiative. And there have been some initiatives that just don't make a lot of legal sense. And you have to clean them up sometimes to effectuate what the intent was. That's why they allowed the legislature to do it. It's a very basic power. It should be exercised very sparingly and only when absolutely necessary.
Okay. I'd like to move off this topic very soon here because I have Mr. Bullard on the line from Let's Legal about the amendment that I may or may not be excuse me, proposing, but Representative Roses.
Yes, I just wanted to address one of the points that Representative Grunberg brought up, and that was the initiative. We only have to wait 18 months, so what's the rush? Quite frankly, I don't think we have a rush. If it hadn't been that ethics and campaign reform was the focal point of every single campaign in the state. So I think that in and of itself gave it some urgency, not only by those that brought the issues up, but by those that had to defend themselves on it, as well as those that were charged as you went door to door and everybody said, you got to clean this mess up. So I think the urgency of dealing with these issues is front and center. And I think a tribute to that are the 13 or 14 bills in the Ethics Committee and the 39 amendments that we've received on those.
And I would agree that ethics is obviously, we have two main issues this session, the gas pipeline, which has not gotten to us yet, and this ethics thing. That's why I've done the very best I can to put everything relating to ethics at the very head of my line in the State Affairs Committee. I'd mentioned this is a memo which I may or may not propose, and there's some questions about it, and I have Mr. Bullard from Ledge Legal on the line. Are you there, sir?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Could you speak to, we got to you with this late yesterday afternoon, I think it was what, about 4:45 or 5 o'clock or something like that. I appreciate your effort in getting something to us. Could you comment on this? I don't know if you heard previous parts of the discussion or not.
I have been tuned into various parts of the discussion, and I did hear some discussion of the amendment. Are there specific questions that you'd like addressed?
Yeah. Anybody on the committee? Reverend Harris, did you have a question about that? As you see this amendment, proposed amendment here, would this perhaps address some of the issues that have been raised before the committee?
Well, part of the discussion that I've heard dealing with this proposed amendment is how it would work in the context of AS 1513-110B and why that was accepted, and how the amendment operates. And what I understood the request to do was to eliminate the need to report if the PAC, and at this time we don't have PACs enshrined in Alaskan statute, so best described in statutory terms as a group that is not a political party, one that has 10 members or less, would be accepted from needing to disclose. And areas in law right now where they have to report are in 1513-040B and 1513-110.
And when, Mr. Bullard, I didn't talk to you last night. I talked to Tam Cook, but I use the numbers 90 and I use the number 10 because it's late in the day. I realize, you know, those numbers could be more or less than 90%, be more or less than 10. I wanted to get the concept on it. And then if we go ahead to this, the committee could debate what those numbers ought to be. Maybe it should be 20, 30, 50, I don't know. But I wanted to get the concept out on the table. Any comment about that? I think
in dealing with this amendment, there may be constitutional concerns of equal protection and free speech. I have not yet had time to map out exactly what those would be.
Representative Cogle, I think, is first.
Probably wasn't going to address the constitutional issue because on allowing people to speak, you want disclosure, and you you create another stratification here between the 90 and 10, what goes...
Or whatever the number would be.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chairman, if we're going to allow groups to have a voice, which we've allowed in Alaska under our law, then I think we should let them have their voice, regardless if it's 10 people, 4 people, 20 people. I mean, there that give the more significant amount. I don't know that I want to go into who has the most dollars involved in a political action committee. Individuals who contribute a certain amount are going to report that anyway. Up over $100, I think they have to say that they've put that contribution level in. So under this law, those under $100 would have to, and that's really the sticking point. The question then is, how do you allow them to influence a campaign? Do you allow them to give 60 members in the legislature $1,000 each, or be able to give, for example, money to a party? You know, you could have a political action group give money to a party, or you could have a subgroup of a party give some to the major part of the party. You can transfer money between these groups. I like the idea that Representative Johnson brought up. Just find out who these folks are. And we can debate whether we should have the $100 limit or not, I think pretty broadly. But I think if you go down into the 90-10 issue, then you have a whole different debate. And I would just urge you, Mr. Chairman, not to go down that road. We already have some pretty clean barriers that I think we can go to. One of them is, how much can they give? Another one, I think we need to somehow highlight who they are. And then the individuals that contribute to them are already known over the $100 limit. So I think that it's in the matter of full disclosure, then the debate goes in, is there a deserving public policy call for anonymity below the $100 limit? And should they be able to give $1,000 or $500, as it says in this particular bill? I think those are cleaner questions because we already know who's giving the lion's share to them. We already know that. Then it's a matter of what is their purpose. I think maybe that could be clouded because of just access to information. And in APOC reporting forms are, maybe we need to ask them to spell out the acronyms. We know what PAC stands for, but we don't know what the go-kart part stands for. We might just want to say, you know, what that is. I put one in last night, and I didn't even remember what the acronym stood for. So I wrote down the whole name of the group because I honestly could not remember what the acronym stood for. And obviously, it's been a lot of distance between the time of receiving it and the time of reporting it. But so I think if we focus on those debates, and it's a legitimate question. If we limit how much a political action committee can give, are we limiting their free speech? Because it where do you draw the limit? Do we say they can only give $100? And you can, you know, we're always going to have the free speech question here. So I think whatever we can do for the most amount of full disclosure, so I would just appeal to you that on this particular amendment, that goes in a different direction. It answers a question, but I think it creates 10 more questions, just for what it's worth, Mr. Chairman.
If I recall, there's a deliberative body, you know, we all know what PAC means because we are all involved in the political realm, but it's amazing how many people out there do not know what PAC stands for. They don't have a
performing
clue.
Arts Center.
Performing clue arts. What this is. I beg your pardon?
The Performing Arts Center.
Performing Arts Center. That's even worse. Representative Greenberg?
Just one thing. Mr. Bullard, you're on the phone. We have Representative Crawford here, and Representative Crawford was involved in a case involving an initiative on We the People, and there was a court decision that came out that I think may be somewhat on point that, Mr. Bullard, you didn't mention in these legal memos we got. I wonder if we could just take a moment, since Representative Crawford is here and Mr. Bullard is on the phone, to chat about that. If Representative Crawford could tell us about that case, and if we can get a copy of it and get it to Mr. Bullard, I want to see if that'll make a difference in these legal opinions. Could we do that since he's here?
It's fine with me. So then, Reverend Crawford, do you want to discuss this, or Mr. Bullard, or what's going on here? What's your request, Representative?
As I understood it, the opinion in We the People.
Trust the People.
Trust whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us, do you have a copy of that? He doesn't mention that in these legal opinions here.
Representative Crawford, did you want to address this?
I would be happy to.
We just have limited time. Just very precisely, just one thing, but not going off in other directions.
Thank you. On the Trust the People initiative that we did, the legislature passed a similar bill.
Well, please identify yourself with it.
Representative Harry Crawford from House District 21. Give you my address, too, if you would like it.
maybe you should be sick.
Anyway, in the Trust the People initiative, we said that we wanted to have an elected U.S. senator, that we didn't want to have an incumbent appointed U.S. senator. In the bill that was passed by the legislature, they said we wanted to have a senator for the interim, that 60 to 90 days where we might have a vacancy. After that bill was passed and the lieutenant governor took the initiative off the ballot, we took it to court, and the Supreme Court decided that that was an actual repeal of a portion of that initiative that was going on the ballot. So they put it back on the ballot.
And how does that apply to the question?
In the repeal part. In that it was not the intent of the initiative to have an interim appointment there, that was repealing, and that they don't have the ability to take that decision away from the people. So I mean, we think that this would be a repeal of a portion of our initiative that we got passed overwhelmingly. We believe that the reason for the 2-year prohibition of repeal is so that the people can actually see how the law works in effect, in practice.
I'm trying to rush along. We have a session coming up here. Representative Johnson first, and then Representative Roses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I fail to see the analogy. The initiative that we're dealing with here says, and what we're talking about really is not more than $1,000, I think. So we are not repealing anything. We're just abiding by it. 500 is less than 1,000.
That wasn't the part
there's
that
a
I was.
Huge, there's a huge difference.
That wasn't the part that I was addressing.
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
I was addressing the part where it repeals the reporting under $100. The reason why we did that was a number of groups like the Alaska Outdoor Council and NRA and different unions had said that was too onerous for reporting each and every person. Like an example would be the Iron Workers Political Action Fund. We collect money by selling hats and gloves and work gloves, that sort of thing, and we get about 50 cents per contribution.
That's relative. I agree with it. That is a.
Okay. That was what I was addressing. Yeah.
I'll pass.
Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Any other quick comment on this bill? If not, I would like to check in with the administration on to clear this up. We have any alleged legal some opinions, and I'd like to check with the Attorney General's office on this portion we're just talking about, and I would like to have, could you check on Representative Roses on better identifying what these acronyms and the mission of PACs are, and I think we probably working out the addresses of police officers and so on. That could be worked out through regulation, I suppose. Okay. Representative Harris, any further comment? So with that, I'm
forward to seeing you again in the future.
I imagine you will. Matter of fact, I'll be seeing you about 10 o'clock, I think. With that, we're going to hold this until the next session.
We're going to love this to death, aren't we?
This is a deliberative body, as somebody said. Do we have enough time?
At least we can take some testimony. We've got a lot of people who've been hearing.
Okay. With that, we're going to go to HB 88, please. And
we have some people online, I believe.
Okay. Let me see who's online here.
Norm, I'm wondering if we have maybe four people here, Mr. Chair. Here's the list.
Where's the list?
And I'm wondering if any of those four have time constraint that they need to testify today.
I have a Mike Kemison. I have a Jay Lerver, a Martha Moore, a Cindy Cashin, it looks like, perhaps. Are those people online now?
Some of them are here.
All right, how many of you are here? Did anybody whose name I just read off have a time constraint? If not, I'm going to go down from the top then. I can hardly read it. Mike
Kemisa.
Kemisa?
The Association of International Auto Manufacturers.
Yes, sir. Could you just identify yourself and please give us your testimony?
Sure, I'd be happy to. My name is Michael Kemisa, and I'm with the Association of International Automobile Manufacturers, or AIAM. We're a trade association. Do you want me to go ahead with the full testimony now?
Yeah, and where are you located?
We're in Arlington, Virginia.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, please.
And AIM is a trade association representing 14 motor vehicle manufacturers who account for over 40% of all light-duty vehicles produced annually in the United States. Our members include Aston Martin, Ferrari, Honda, Hyundai, Isuzu, Kia, Maserati, Mitsubishi, Nissan, Peugeot, Renault, Subaru, Suzuki, and Toyota. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me to participate in this hearing on the important issue of driver distraction from video displays in motor vehicles. AIM wishes to support your process of developing legislation intended to prevent operators of motor vehicles from watching television, video, and other entertainment programming while driving. AIM supports your goal of trying to keep drivers from being distracted by viewing images unrelated to the driving task, and we have developed some model language that we believe accomplishes this goal while addressing two main concerns, which are, one, we want to ensure that new state requirements do not inadvertently prohibit technology that can assist the driver in the driving task, things such as navigation systems or vehicle information displays, and technology for monitoring forward, rear, and side views to help the driver maneuvering the vehicle. And these devices also make use of video or image display devices. Likewise, we'd like to see that the legislation does not inadvertently prohibit image display devices that have been designed with appropriate safeguards that are intended to prevent the driver from watching the images while the vehicle is in motion. And then our second concern is it's our hope that states passing legislation to address this issue will adopt clear and consistent requirements, clear so that vehicle manufacturers will know what the rules are when designing the vehicles, and consistent so that the same vehicles can be sold and driven throughout the country. Thanks again for this opportunity to share our thoughts with you, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have now or to follow up with you on this issue at a later time.
I'd like to thank you for your testimony. Any questions for the gentleman, Representative Gruenberg?
Yes, Mr. Kemisa. Appreciate your testimony. Have you had a chance to look at the bill?
Yes. I saw a version of HB 88. I think it was sent to me within the last week, so I don't know if there's been any changes to it in the meantime.
Not within the last week. Does your organization support that bill?
Essentially, I I provided a few markups to the language to I think we're keeping the same intent, just to clarify things a little bit, and shared them with your staff member, Mr. Cohen.
Yes, if you do that before the next meeting, we sure would appreciate it. Thank you, sir. Is Jay Landers back online?
Yes, speaking. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good so far. Good. Would you please identify yourself and the group you represent and where you're located?
Absolutely. I'm with the Recreation Vehicle Industry Association. That is the arm of the that represents the RV manufacturers. We represent about 98% of all the RV manufacturers, and I'm based in Northern Virginia as well. We have worked pretty closely with not only the automobile manufacturers, but also with the Consumer Electronics Association to try to develop language that would satisfy everybody's concerns. Similarly to the car manufacturers, what we're looking for is uniformity among the states, and the bills from laws that have already passed have succeeded with this concern so far. One of the things I would mention is that there are some RVs that already have the televisions up front. What we've done is built into that any of those models. Basically, it's an interlock device, so that as soon as the RV, the key goes into the ignition and it's switched into the on position, the circuit to those televisions is cut automatically, and they cannot be viewed while you're driving down the street.
Ms. Lerner?
So we are we're not supportive of any kind of handheld movie device sitting on the side of the passenger side, but we certainly are working with the other groups, as I mentioned, to make sure that everybody's concerns are dealt with. The way I've seen the bill so far, I believe it addresses our concerns, but again, we work closely with both the car manufacturers and the Consumer Electronics Association, as well as the staff, to make sure all concerns are taken care of.
Well, I can thank you for your testimony, sir. You said you're from Virginia. What city are you in there?
We're very close to, it's Reston, which is very close to Dulles Airport.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions while he's online? I'd like to thank you for your testimony, sir.
Very good.
And the bells are ringing. We're going to go into floor session here for a moment. So I'm going to ask a little patience from the other folks we had here to testify, Cindy and Martha. So I wouldn't want to take and rush you through your testimony. So I thank you very much. Anything else to come before the committee? I would remind the committee that I believe it's tonight, the subcommittee on ethics is meeting once again. What time is that?
Five.
At 5 o'clock, and where will that be?
Speaker.
In the speaker's chamber.
Speaker's chamber, and I would invite everybody to be there. With that, House State Affairs Committee is adjourned.